first thing I want to do is welcome you to George Washington University Law School. I'm Lee Paddock. I'm Associate Dean for Environmental Law Studies here. I want to thank, first of all, the Environmental Law Society at Georgetown University Law School and the Environmental Law Association at George Washington University for helping to organize this program. So a round of applause is probably appropriate for the organizers. So. I also want to recognize one of the pioneers in environmental law and one of the real worldwide experts in the Clean Air Act. He was here, Arnold Ricey. Arnold is going to be here for a few more weeks, and then we'll be out hiking the Wasatch in Utah. So thank you, Arnold, for being here and all of your contributions to environmental law in George Washington University. I also want to thank the Environmental Law Institute, who we're very pleased to have the opportunity to work with on a number of occasions for helping to organize the program and advertise the program and being our partner in this effort. We've got a number of joint enterprises with the Environmental Law Institute. We hope a year and a half from now, the Environmental Law Institute, George Washington University, and the Council on Environmental Quality will be hosting a 40th anniversary of a National Environmental Policy Act conference here at George Washington. That's one example of efforts to work together with the Environmental Law Institute. So with that, I want to turn the first panel over to Leslie Carruthers, who is president of the Environmental Law Institute and our moderator for the first panel.
Thank you, Lee. I'm too delighted to be here and especially to be sponsoring this with the Association of Environmental Law Societies and especially the Georgetown and George Washington school chapters. And I'm especially proud and pleased to be doing this with Lee Paddock, the new associate dean here at the George Washington Law School. I happen to be an alumna of the Environmental Law Master's program, and so it's a special pleasure to be able to thank as well Arnold Ricey, who was one of my teachers. And Arnold and I've sort of had a running joke over the years because he gave me my lowest grade in the master's program. He gave me an 89, spoiling my average. And I think it was because I could not answer the question about how many tons of coal had been mined in Montana in 1937. It was a question of that nature, I believe, on one of his vicious exams. But anyway, we have had the privilege of publishing some of his books over the years, and he is indeed a pioneer in the establishing a wonderful academic concentration in the environmental law field, and I don't know of anyone who's contributed more to that effort. So we're delighted you could be here, Arnold, and we wish you a good hike, as well as many other activities and what I'm sure will be a busy retirement. I am chairing the first panel today of two. This program is being sponsored from ELI's perspective by our Endangered Environmental Laws program, and I want to say why that is. As many of you know, ELI is an independent, nonpartisan education and policy research outfit. We try very hard not to take sides, but we occasionally do take positions. And one of our positions in the Endangered Laws program is grounded in increasing concern about challenges on constitutional grounds to some of the framework of our national environmental laws. Some of those challenges involve questioning the Clean Water Act or the reach of the Endangered Species Act under the Commerce Clause. These are serious issues that continue to bubble around in the courts. Among the things that we consider to be pillars of the effective national program that we've had since the 70s are two of the topics that we'll be getting into today. One of them is citizen standing and access to the courts in order to seek redress of environmental damages and harms. And the other is the ability of our states to innovate and to go beyond federal requirements in coming up with creative solutions to environmental problems. Of course, in the case of global warming, any state regulation exceeds federal requirements because right now there aren't any. I think that will probably change regardless of who is elected next year. We have two panels today. The first one is on the political question doctrine and standing, and that's the one my associates here and I are presenting, and then Lee will chair the second, and he will introduce those panelists. I have with me a terrific group of panelists. I'm going to give you a very cryptic introduction of them, much more than their resumes, much less than their resumes would suggest, but in the interest of time, let me do that. I'll start on my right with John Echevarria, who is the Executive Director of the Georgetown Environmental Law and Policy Institute at Georgetown. He's the former General Counsel of the National Audubon Society, as well as American Rivers, and a graduate of the Yale Law School, as well as the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He's written extensively on many environmental topics, especially takings issues, and I guess the one thing I'll mention is his most recent honor was he just received the Jefferson Fordham Advocacy Award at the Bar Association, recognizing excellence within the area of state and local government law over a lifetime of achievement. John, I didn't think you were that old, but still.
That's very commendable.
To my immediate left is Joseph Guerra, who is a partner in the appellate practice of the Washington office of Sidley Austin. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia, and among his distinctions was serving as a law clerk to Associate Justice William J. Brennan, the late Justice Brennan of the United States Supreme Court. He also served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, and he is representing American Electric Power Company, or did represent them, well, it's not over, in the Connecticut v. AEP case that we'll be talking about today. And finally, Benjamin Crass is an associate at the law offices of Matthew Power, and he represents the plaintiffs in Open Space Institute versus American Electric Power Company, that case. He received his JD from Boston College Law School, where he was managing editor of the BC Environmental Affairs Law Review, and has also served as an adjunct professor, lecturer on environmental law in the political science department at the college. So these are the three panelists, and let me explain how we're planning to proceed. What I will do initially is ask John to talk about the basic doctrine of political question and the standing issues, sort of as a giving an overview of the issue, and then I will ask each of the other presenters to talk about their cases, Connecticut versus AEP, and the case of Comer versus Murphy Oil. Following that, and they're each supposed to talk no more than about 7 minutes, I have some questions that I'm going to pose to all of them to just get the discussion going, and then we will save at least 15 minutes so that we can have questions from the audience. So with that, John, if you will start with the overview, you have the floor.
Very good. Thank you, Leslie. As she mentioned, she asked me to give you an overview of political question doctrine. I'm going to focus mostly on that and less on standing, which is less central to these cases we're going to be discussing. I'm also going to describe, by way of example, how this doctrine has been applied in the past, and then discuss the elements of this doctrine that appear to be relevant in the context of global warming litigation. Now, starting at a very general level, the political question doctrine is one member of a family of doctrines, including, for example, standing and ripeness that the courts invoke in order to justify not resolving cases. Depending on your point of view, these doctrines serve to ensure that the courts only resolve concrete disputes appropriate for judicial treatment. Alternatively, relying on a different point of view, they're vehicles sometimes for courts to avoid hard issues, and even sometimes for ruling in favor of defendants when they want to achieve that result but prefer to rely on seemingly more neutral procedural grounds for achieving that result. Now, for over 40 years, the U.S. Supreme Court, in its Baker versus Carr decision, has laid out the basic political question test. There are, in fact, six independent parts of that test that are used to identify the existence of a political question, making the case inappropriate for judicial resolution. And since there's no way to avoid it, I'm going to briefly read you the six tests. One, a textually demonstrable commitment of an issue to a coordinate political department, that is, Congress or the executive branch. Two, a lack of judicially discoverable and manageable standards for resolving the case. Three, the impossibility of deciding the case without an initial policy determination of a kind clearly for non-judicial discretion. Four, the impossibility of a court's undertaking independent resolution without expressing lack of the respect due coordinate branches of government. Five, an unusual need for unquestioning adherence to a political decision already made. Or six, the potential for embarrassment for multifarious pronouncement by various departments on one question. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, I guess the panel does not need to repeat those factors. As with so many legal tests or standards, the language doesn't tell you a whole lot, especially when the test has six subparts, as in this case. And the only way to really figure out what the parameters of this kind of doctrine is to look at the cases that have been applied. Indeed, the Supreme Court has said that the determination of whether a political question exists is a quote-unquote delicate exercise in constitutional interpretation that must be conducted on a case-by-case basis. The court itself has said that one must analyze representative cases and infer from them the analytical threads that make up the political question doctrine. Now, the last three independent tests that I mentioned are I'm going to ignore for the rest of this presentation because they have no particular relevance in the global warming context because they address the question of whether or not the court should appropriately challenge some important and possibly hard to reverse decision that other branches of government have already taken. Since, as we all know, the federal government hasn't done much of anything on global warming, there's not much of a decision for the judicial branch to contradict. So our focus is on the first three factors. And in fact, those three factors have all played a role in the cases we'll be talking about, and I assume the other panelists will be talking in detail about how these other factors have played out in global warming cases. Now, the first factor is whether or not there has been a textually demonstrable commitment of the issue to some other branch of government. Let me give you two examples. The Supreme Court has said that congressional impeachment proceedings and the rules governing those are really assigned to Congress to resolve, not something for the courts to address. Another example involves decisions relating to U.S. foreign affairs, such as under what terms a treaty with another country can be resolved. These cases deal with questions of jurisdiction. Has a question been assigned, although it may fall within the court's general jurisdiction, is there a clear indication that this specific question has been assigned for resolution to some other branch of government? If so, then it is not an issue for the courts to resolve. The second and third tests really focused not so much on jurisdiction, but the question of whether or not there are rules that the courts can apply. The second test asks whether there are judicially manageable standards for the courts to use. Thus, for example, the Supreme Court has said if somebody asks them whether or not the guarantee of a Republican form of government is being carried out, the court has said there's no content to that guarantee from which we can derive rules to apply. Similarly, with respect to the naturalization clause in the Constitution, there are no judicially manageable standards to be applied. And likewise, with respect to U.S. military policies as they apply to other countries. Under this prong, the courts have generally said that suits seeking injunctive relief are more likely to raise political questions than those seeking monetary relief. And then finally, there's the third test, which focuses on whether a case would require a court to make an initial policy determination that is best left to the other branches of government. At least based on my cursory research, it appears the courts have given relatively little guidance on the meaning of this factor, other than to observe that it's closely related to the second factor. And I guess the idea is that if the courts, in order to resolve an issue, have to make some initial policy determination, they'd have to do so in order to develop some coherent rule that they can apply. So those are the three factors. We'll talk about how they'll play out, how they have played out in global warming cases. Let me just close by making my personal observation that there seem to be some very good reasons the doubt that the courts are competent to resolve global warming litigation in an effective and useful way. But I'm not sure that the political question doctrine provides the right way to address the relevant issues of judicial competence and case manageability. Certainly, it is hard to say that the constitutional text assigns the issue, or any other text, assigns the issue of global warming to some other branch of government, or that the courts are incapable of applying the relatively non-revolutionary tort law principles that are involved in these cases. On the other hand, the contributors to global warming are so numerous, and the difficulty of coming up with a manageable legal standard, never mind coming up with a remedy, are so daunting that I'm quite confident that the courts are not the proper forum to be resolving national policy on global warming. But I wonder, and this is a somewhat uneducated wondering, if the better and more honest way to get to the point is by exploring the permissible limits of the federal common law rather than by invoking the political question doctrine. So with that introduction, I will pass the baton.
Thank you.
Sure.
Joe, you'll go next.
Sure. I just want to just say by way of opening disclaimer that I'm here speaking on my own behalf and representing my own views, and I did argue on behalf of the defendants in the Second Circuit in the Connecticut case, and I represent a utility in the Comer case, but my views are that I'm going to express today are mine and not my clients. And I've been asked to just briefly describe the Comer litigation, which is probably unknown to everyone here by that name, but we all refer to it as the Katrina litigation. And the lawsuit there involved claims under Mississippi tort law by Mississippi residents who alleged that essentially the coal mining industry, the electric utility industry, the oil and gas producing industry, and the chemical industry are responsible by virtue of their emissions of various greenhouse gases, principally carbon dioxide, but not exclusively. They are responsible for exacerbating global warming to such an extent that it caused the intensification of traditional cyclonic storms in the Gulf of Mexico, thereby turning Katrina from a Category 2 hurricane into the disastrous hurricane that it was, and that therefore those defendants should be liable in damages to all the state residents who were injured by Katrina. The arguments that we made to this complaint were basically two. We said, and this was we being, there were many, many lawyers, as you might imagine, representing many different clients in this case. But generally, the two main arguments that were advanced were on the merits were, number one, the plaintiffs don't have standing to bring this lawsuit because under Article 3, there are three prongs to Article 3, as you well know. And the argument here was that the traceability requirement between the conduct of the various defendants and the injuries that these plaintiffs sustained was not satisfied because either there were simply too many links in the causal chain to get from digging coal from West Virginia to hurricane force winds destroying people's homes on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, or alternatively there were the injuries could not be directly traceable to any of the defendants in the courtroom because greenhouse gas emissions are contributed by literally billions of entities around the globe, and therefore there's simply no way to determine that these groups of defendants should bear financial responsibility for these injuries. The second argument was the political question argument. Professor mentioned what are the limits of federal common law, and that was a big issue in the Connecticut case. It was not an issue at all in the Mississippi case because it was this traditional Mississippi tort suit under state law. The second argument, therefore, was this case is non-justiciable because it's simply impossible to make a determination of liability without undertaking a balancing of competing societal interests that courts have no competence or standards to balance. And briefly, the argument is because carbon dioxide is emitted by so many sources, because it is not itself inherently harmful when and it's the harms of global warming are caused only by the collective action of all the emissions, and there's no way to trace any set of emissions to any particular types of harms. As a result, it's simply impossible to determine what levels of any one entities' emissions have become so unreasonable because they've caused an increased risk of cyclonic intensification. And one of the examples to illustrate this point is, suppose scientifically you could actually demonstrate that to avoid the risk of intensification of hurricanes, you could demonstrate that the utilities among the defendants should have stopped producing energy or would have had to stop producing energy by the year 2000 because of the lag time of the effect of carbon dioxide emissions. How could you make the determination that the failure to do that was unreasonable as a tort principle without balancing the impacts of such a reduction of electricity production on all of the industries, all the consumers, all the health implications? And so once you formulate the problem in those terms, you realize that a judge is being asked to weigh societal imponderables, and that that job is for the political branches. And Judge Girola in Mississippi, who was who heard the case, did dismiss it. He did dismiss the case, he said, on standing grounds for the reasons I just mentioned. He said that there was no way to trace the injuries to these defendants. But he also went on to opine that he agreed that there was really no way to determine what would be unreasonable conduct in this arena, and therefore, although he didn't formally dismiss on political question grounds, he seemed to indicate that he thought that was a supporting reason as well.
Okay, Ben, it falls to you to explain the theory of the neutral theory of these cases and how it's turned out so far.
Thank you. So on July 21st, 2004, eight states, California, Connecticut, Iowa, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, Wisconsin, and the city of New York filed a case in federal district court in Manhattan against the five largest emitters of carbon dioxide in the electric utility industry: American Electric Power, Southern Company, Tennessee Valley Authority, Xcel Energy, and Synergy Corporation, which has since merged with Duke Energy. My firm represented three land trust plaintiffs: the Open Space Institute, the Open Space Conservancy, and the Audubon Society of New Hampshire, that filed a companion case in the same court on the same day. Our cause of action was the federal common law of public nuisance, which we sued under because it applies to unregulated interstate pollution, and as we all know, carbon dioxide emissions are unregulated and obviously cross state boundaries. Thus, the case was one pitting domestic plaintiffs against domestic defendants over domestic emissions of carbon dioxide causing domestic harm within the respective states. Public nuisance is simply an unreasonable interference with rights common to the general public. We targeted, as I said, the largest emitters of carbon dioxide in the electric utility sector. They represent approximately 40% of the carbon dioxide emissions, the power sector represents about 40% of the carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, and the five defendants that we sued in this case represent a quarter or 25% of the power sector's carbon dioxide emissions. And so from that, you analogize, and these five defendants represent 10% of all U.S. carbon dioxide emissions from human activities. Again, extrapolating from that, and it's the defendants have conceded in the briefs, I believe, the defendants have characterized themselves as representing 2.5% of worldwide emissions. And you play out the numbers, and if we're looking at major actors emitting carbon dioxide, that comes out to about 200 major contributors to carbon dioxide emissions worldwide, which I would postulate is not an unreasonable number of parties, and actually is a relatively small number, much smaller than you would expect when you first think about who's contributing to the problem. The complaints seek injunctive and declaratory relief, not damages. We seek a court order requiring the plants to gradually reduce their emissions over a period of 10 years. We're not seeking to shut down the plants. And so I think that Joe was going into some of the factors that would be considered in a balancing test. We're not talking about shutting down the electric utility sector. We've alleged in the complaint that these power plant operators have efficient and economical means available to them to gradually reduce their emissions, such thing as switching fuels, in other words, burning less oil, burning more natural gas, more carbon-free sources, increasing demand-side management, so there's less demand for electricity. And if people remember back to the electricity crisis in California, if you remember at the time, the state requested people to reduce their consumption of electricity, and the gains on the demand side were drastic. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I'm thinking electricity usage went down something like 20% or something. The court, defendants brought various motions to dismiss, including for lack of standing, and they raised a generalized separation of powers argument, and the history of how the political question doctrine actually emerged in this case is somewhat interesting. The defendants never specifically invoked the political question doctrine in their briefs, and in particular the brief stated, the Baker v. Carr test for determining when the political question doctrine bars adjudication of a recognized cause of action is thus wholly irrelevant. When asked at oral argument by the judge whether the defendants were invoking the political question doctrine, Joe, who's sitting next to me, who was representing the defendants, and I don't mean to pick on Joe.
I suspect I'm getting picked on here today.
Stated to the court, in all honesty, that is not the motion that we filed. And yet the court, sua sponte, dismissed the case on political question grounds. That was back in September 2005. We appealed to the Second Circuit. Oral argument was held before the Second Circuit in June of 2006. After Massachusetts v. EPA came down this year, they asked us to submit supplemental briefs, and that was in July, and we are awaiting a decision.
All right.
Well, it may not be fair to start with you, Ben, but I guess I'll ask you, do you think that the results so far in these cases suggest that this theory is not going to succeed in the global warming context, that nuisance theories will not succeed?
I don't. I remember when I was a law clerk at the Environmental Enforcement Section at the Department of Justice here in D.C., one of the learning principles that they taught us was, I don't have a big board, but they said, you know, what kind of course do you think normal litigation takes? And of course, everybody kind of drew a straight line and said, you know, it kind of proceeds rationally like this, because we're all lawyers, right? And the attorney said, well, no, this is my experience of how litigation proceeds in trial. And so we're standing right here right now. And so the fact that two district courts... We hope. The fact that two district courts have dismissed global warming cases on political question grounds doesn't foreclose the viability of these cases, I don't think. Both cases have been appealed to the respective circuit courts, and the other case I'm referring to is the General Motors versus California case out in California. And the reasoning of that district court relied heavily on the reasoning espoused by the court in our case. And so if, as we expect, we get a reversal in the Second Circuit, I think it would cut the underpinnings of that decision out. And so I just remind people we're at the motion to dismiss stage. There's been no facts introduced. We're merely seeking an opportunity to present facts to the court.
Okay, John, would you like to comment on that question? Relates to your point about possibly other theories that might be brought to bear.
I guess you have to draw the conclusion based on the results so far that it doesn't look too promising for the plaintiffs. And I guess what I'm not sure that the political question defense holds water, and I guess counsel for the companies agrees with that.
I'd like a chance to.
But
I'm
think
my turn.
We'll
but
I think I think there are probably a range of alternative arguments. I think the bottom line is the courts feel incompetent to resolve issues of this magnitude and involving this many players, involving difficult problems of setting a standard, establishing a remedy, international relations. I'm not sure the doctrine really fits naturally into political question doctrine as it's been articulated to date, but the courts are going to be very reluctant to do this. I think there's sort of two questions here. One is whether or not this is a legally viable strategy, and the other one whether it's a smart strategy. And I think it's worth raising the question of whether or not litigation effort is appropriately focused on this issue. One wise person said recently that the priority of the environmental community, the only priority, ought to be litigating to stop every new coal plant in America, and that's the number one priority, and resources would be better focused exclusively on that goal.
All right, Joe, defend yourself.
Sure.
I just want to, and this is just, you know, defend my own advocacy. Professor mentioned that he thought one way of challenging these lawsuits, particularly the lawsuit that Ben was describing, is to contest the actual ability of federal common law to redress these types of problems. And that was the thrust of our motion to dismiss. And our arguments, as Ben suggested, were based on separation of powers principles, that federal common lawmaking is a very limited power that courts have simply exercised in, out of sort of constitutional necessity. The interstate nuisance cases, for example, arose at a time when it was thought that Congress did not have the power to redress in-state pollution that might cause harms in another state. And so the Supreme Court decided that somebody had to do something about it, and that they were the only actor left. And so we made a very lengthy argument about how that theory does not apply today with the expansive powers of Congress under the Commerce Clause, and therefore there was no cause of action at all. And as Ben accurately states, when Judge Preska asked me whether the political question was in fact the basis of our motion, I said it was not, because that was true. But I did then go on to invite her, since she seemed very keen on doing so, to nevertheless reach that result. She set out a decision tree, and she said, if I disagree with you about the existence of a cause of action, don't I get to political question? I said, you do, and at that point I explained why some of the many same reasons that underlied our principal argument applied as well there. I would say, I personally, and just to put my cards on the table, I personally think that global warming is a very serious problem and something should be done about it. I also very personally think that the courts are not the governmental institution that ought to try to solve the problem for a host of reasons, many of which I think fall under the rubric of the political question doctrine. I don't view the first standard as jurisdictional in the sense that it's sort of an exclusive commitment. I think some of the cases that John mentioned are in fact cases where the court has said only Congress has the authority to do something here because the impeachment clause is assigned to it. But I do think that the Commerce Clause and the foreign affairs powers in this case are in fact textual commitments of responsibility to address problems of this vast scope. And in terms of the interference with statements by other branches, we have argued that in fact the U.S. foreign policy position, at least under this administration, has been no mandatory unilateral reductions by the United States, because that could cause harm to our economy with no net benefit as other economies pump out more greenhouse gases. And so there is, we argue, a way in which judicially mandated reductions do undermine that foreign policy, which is committed solely to the president's discretion. And I think the lack of standards really is the key point here. In my judgment, and we've argued this obviously on the merits, I don't think courts have the ability to determine when emissions become societally unreasonable. And Ben mentioned that they don't seek a shutdown because, for obvious reasons, they couldn't. But that doesn't mean that the problems disappear. Congress itself has passed statutes in which it has explicitly recognize the significant social, economic, and national security implications of changing the way we generate power in this country, and saying we want you to reduce your emissions does not make those problems go away, because Congress in its statute isn't suggesting that those only arise if you shut down power plants. So once you recognize that there are significant costs to any mechanism for resolving this problem, then you have to ask yourself, what's the proper way to balance those costs? Why, for example, should the electric industry be the target? Why not go after emissions of methane gas, which have much higher heat-retaining properties than carbon dioxide? What are the relevant? What is the balance of costs if you pick on one industry versus another? All of which could be labeled as significant or major contributors. And how do you decide what the right balance of economic costs and harms are across our society? And I think to just state the question is to recognize that that's an answer that has to come from the political branches. That's their job.
Let me ask Ben to comment on how he thinks or how he's argued the courts would go about setting standards for decision in this type of case. This is part of what Joe is saying is practically impossible given all the balancing. How would you be arguing this point when you go forward?
Sure. So the standard for a public nuisance is an unreasonable interference with public rights. And so how do you begin to unpack that? One thing that the court would look at is the level at which global warming becomes dangerous. And that would be something that we could present scientific expert testimony on. And in fact, in the second panel, the case that's involved in that panel, the Green Mountain case, that was testimony of that nature was admitted and received at that trial.
You're referring to the case involving the auto standards in Vermont. Okay. You might mention to people what that is.
I don't want to take the province of the next panel, but that case involved a challenge by several automobile manufacturers to a law passed by Vermont and numerous other states limiting tailpipe emissions of carbon dioxide.
Okay, good.
A second factor, so once you established at what level global warming becomes dangerous, you'd want to look at what corresponding level of carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere corresponds to that dangerous level. And then you'd want to ask yourself, well, if we want to avoid the most dangerous impacts of global warming, what do we need to hold that level of carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere at? And then you would apportion out for defendants their appropriate share of the reductions in those emissions. And one of the important principles of this case is the principle of joint and separate liability, which states that we do not need to sue every contributor to the problem in the case. We've sued the five major ones, in our opinion. And so we're asking them to reduce their emissions to do their share of the problem. And under the principle of joint and several liability, we do not need to show that reducing their emissions by a specified portion would solve the problem. We need to demonstrate to the court that if we set specific emissions reductions for these five defendants, that it would contribute to solving the problem through their fair share. With respect to the states, they mentioned in their brief things to consider would be what policies have the plaintiff states themselves enacted. And some of the panelists on the second panel may be able to speak to specific policies, but the Northeast states, for example, have created the REGI framework, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, in efforts to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from those states. And of course, you would look at the cost of the companies. But again, at this stage of the case where the allegations of the complaint are taken as true, and we've alleged that the companies have available to them economical means to reduce their emissions, we're entitled to get into a factual stage of the case to be able to present our facts to the court that support that allegation.
Well, let me ask Joe to comment on that. I mean, don't you think a fuller record after discovery might make a difference?
No, I don't, because I think the problems that we're talking about, the issues, are not specific to any one set of defendants, because the societal balance that I'm talking about is still a weighing of all kinds of factors that go well beyond the impact on any one defendant. And I would just comment on a couple of points that Ben made. One is, it's true that there's a joint and several liability principle, but the question here is, does that make this case justiciable? And we say it does not, because you can't effectively resolve. Courts are supposed to offer meaningful redress to the problems that they are confronting. And saying that every little bit counts doesn't really fly in this context, because you could reduce by some percentage the emissions of these companies, and it could have absolutely no impact on global warming, because there are so many other emitters, both in the United States and outside the United States, who remain able to continue their emissions, that you can have no impact whatsoever, notwithstanding the costs that you've imposed. And it's no answer to say, but we're allowed to do that under joint and several liability principles, because the question then is, for one thing, do you have standing at that point to seek relief that does not actually redress the problems that you're claiming you bring this lawsuit to redress? And then you have the problem of, what happens when you decide to bring your other 200 lawsuits
Where do you get venue over all of those people? Can you actually bring them all into the United States courts? And then is there any way to rationalize the remedies across all of those cases? And we submit that's not possible, and that, again, is the reason why it has to be done by the political branches.
Let me ask John to comment on the issue of whether discovery and getting a factual record would help, and the standards question, and how have the courts dealt with anything that you regard as similar to this in terms of those issues? Could you broaden our perspective a little?
Well, I was focusing on the question of this whether or not this is an inappropriate judicial balancing exercise being involved here. And one of my concerns about these cases, and if they come out the wrong way from an environmental defense standpoint, whether or not they might have collateral consequences that would be undesirable. In reading these opinions, one gets the impression that the courts think that nuisance law involves a balancing of interests, of economic and environmental interests. It's very complicated, and courts don't do that. They just apply statutes. And read for all they're worth, these decisions might suggest that there really shouldn't be any kind of common law nuisance remedies for environmental harms whatsoever. And I think it's sort of not surprising that the courts are using those terms, because after all, they're applying one of the standards, which is whether there's a judicially discoverable and manageable standard, and they're saying, well, we have a hard time finding a judicially and manageable standard in nuisance law. But I think what they really mean is there are too many parties. We don't know how to craft the relief, but where do you find that consideration in political question doctrine, which is, of course, precisely why you never raise the defense in the first place. I am concerned that sort of that these decisions are sort of overbroad, and in trying to find a way to defeat the claims, there's loose language that could be very harmful to common law nuisance litigation. The other thing I just want to mention briefly is I was very troubled by the statement in the California case, which I guess is the most recent of them, that the Commerce Clause could be invoked as a textual assignment of jurisdiction to the congressional branches, because essentially all environmental law and litigation relates to impacts on commerce. That's the basis for all environmental law. And again, that, taken for all it's worth, that means that any impact on the environment relating to commerce is something that the common law courts can't address, period. I don't think the court necessarily wanted to go that far, but that's the implication of regarding the Commerce Clause as a textual assignment of responsibility to the congressional branches of those kinds of issues.
If I could just quickly respond to Joe's remarks about joint and several liability. With all due respect, I mean, the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA and the district court's decision in the Green Mountain case, and I should disclose that I was counsel for several environmental groups that intervene on behalf of the state to defend the law in that case. In the Green Mountain case, the judge specifically found that although the plaintiff automakers in that case argued that, look, this regulation is not going to amount to a meaningful reduction of carbon dioxide emissions. You cannot say that if we reduce emissions from automobile tailpipes in X percentage that we're going to get X degrees less of warming. And the judge specifically found that it is due to the laws of chemistry and physics that if there is a reduction in emissions of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, there is by force a reduction in the amount of warming. And so that speaks directly to the joint and several liability principle in our case. Similar in Massachusetts v. EPA, the court similarly found in a standing context that there is no need to show that it was an insufficient argument to defeat standing, that you could not specifically show that a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions of X amount would translate into a reduction in X degrees of warming. And with respect to opening the floodgates, you know, to future cases, I mean, I would just note that since the Connecticut case was filed, there's been very few global warming cases filed. In injunctive relief cases, there's not much incentive for other plaintiffs to file their own cases, quite honestly. They're complex cases that require a lot of resources and will involve expert scientific testimony. It's not a lot of parties that are capable in terms of resources of bringing such cases. Plaintiffs traditionally target the biggest contributors. I don't think there's a plaintiff out there that's going to go sue somebody that's contributing a minuscule amount of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere. And of course, the significant contributors have plenty of resources. And to the extent that there is several cases that are filed, I mean, federal courts are certainly capable of dealing with complex multi-district litigations and have mechanisms set up to do that. So I really don't think that that is a concern.
Matt?
Sure.
Just a couple of points. On the floodgates point, I guess I have two reactions. One is, and this is an argument we made to the Second Circuit, the very decision about who to sue is itself a policy decision. It's the same policy decision we've been talking about. Where would you get the most bang for the buck? What are the least disruptive ways of addressing greenhouse gas emissions across our national economy? And in effect, Ben's point is that, you know, unelected, in the state case, they are elected, but in Ben's case, he's not yet, anyhow. Those individuals are free to bring these lawsuits and make the policy judgment, or at least run the policy judgment up the flag to see if a federal judge is going to agree with it. And it may be that there's been restraint so far, but, I mean, there's nothing in the theory of the case that says that if this case succeeds, there's only going to be a couple of year afterwards. And on the point about the emissions, two things, really. One is that we're not questioning the scientific proposition that a reduction, if everything else holds steady and you reduce one person's emissions, that would have some beneficial effect. The point we make is there are all these other people out there over whom you have no control, unless and until you manage to bring them into U.S. courts under the same theory, and so their emissions can go up. And that's actually the very point of the U.S. Foreign policy position. You can agree or disagree with it, but that's the principle, and one of the reasons EPA has initially declined to regulate emissions from cars is that we, the United States, could impose significant burdens on ourselves for no net gain because the economies of Southeast Asia, China, what have you, are pumping away, and we're doing something for no net benefit.
It sounds like an alternative defense. The lawsuit can't go forward for lack of joinder of necessary parties, and you should be moving to join all the other emitters in the world. And if the court can't handle that, then they should dismiss the lawsuit.
I do think we had a footnote noting that.
Well, why don't we conclude this part and then open for questions, but with a question about, John, you've already talked about it. You can elaborate if you like. If the nuisance cases are not turning out successfully, at least so far, and they're both on appeal, so that's not a foregone conclusion, but what should the public interest community be doing to try to move action in this area?
Well, I guess there are three obvious things. One is to press the Congress to take comprehensive action, and that is the debate is in full swing, and they're really getting down to brass tacks about what kind of cap and trade or auction system will be involved. And there's a raging political debate about whether it makes sense to cut a deal now when there's a lot of attention focused on this, or whether President Clinton will sign a better bill and therefore it ought to be deferred. The other thing is EPA. State of California has brought suit seeking permission to implement its version of global warming legislation in the aftermath of the MAS versus EPA case. There's certainly EPA is planning to do something, and apparently I gather they've made a policy decision to make the necessary determinations to justify further action. So that's going to be important. And then the final thing is, as I mentioned, is coal, that there are on the drawing boards plans for scores of additional coal-emitting plants. No matter what else we do, adding more coal plants, which will have a life of, what, 30, 40, 50 years, will each one that's built will make it harder and harder to deal with the problem. and what was it, Kansas authorities recently turned down a permit for a coal plant based on global warming impacts. And if it can happen in Kansas, it probably can happen in a lot of other places.
Do either of you want to comment on this point? You are the probably the one whose ox is getting gored here, but
well,
go ahead.
I personally think that a legislative solution is where the energies ought to be devoted, and I actually, the clients I represent think that as well. I think there are, you know, a number of businesses have said something is coming, and we know that, and what we want is a predictable, rational system. We don't want to incur significant expense for sequestration and capture technologies because some judge tells us to do that and then find out 3 years down the road that Congress isn't mandating that, it's mandating something else and we have to retrofit. So there's actually a very significant amount of impetus within the regulated or to be regulated sectors of the economy in wanting some certainty here and recognizing that something's coming and they want to be part of the discussion about how it ought to be put together. But I, obviously, from everything I've said, I don't think lawsuits are the appropriate.
Okay, Ben, you get the last word, sure. And then we'll open up for questions.
Just to pick up on Joe's comment, I mean, one of the great ironies about the fact that the defendants invoked the political doctrine, so to speak, in our case, is that historically it's been the electric utility sector that has lobbied hard against any regulation in Congress, and now they're arguing to the court that this is not something that the court should deal with, but the elected political branches, while at the same time they're lobbying behind the scenes to make sure that nothing isn't enacted. I mean, again, that's, you know, a general proposition with respect to the electric utility industry. You know, one thing to remember, again, is that any decision on the merits in this case is not a constitutional decision. Congress can change the rules. They can set their own emission limits. So there's no danger here that the court is going to have the last word. In terms of other options, I mean, in my understanding, any kind of regulations is going to have similar pitfalls in the sense that EPA will set, could set emission limits. One side or the other or both will sue over what the exact limits are. That will be in litigation for years. I don't think that that's necessarily any better than the course of action we're taking. And I should mention that if we are successful in the Second Circuit, depending on whether there's an appeal to the Supreme Court, once the case gets back, generally, you're not allowed to appeal up to the Circuit Court until there's a final decision. And so the case, compared to what it's moved like so far, would proceed relatively quickly. And that may have been, in fact, one of the reasons why the district court judges wanted to get them to the Circuit Court, because if they had ruled the other way, likely there would not have been any appeal for some time in the case.
All right. Well, thank you, panel. It's now time. We have about 10 minutes, I think, so we can get out of here and the next panel can come in to hear your questions. Do you want me to repeat them?
Yes,
my technical staff over here, which I thank, wants me to repeat the questions because we are recording this so that people can dial in and listen to it. So who's got a question? Yes, sir.
I had a question about Massachusetts EPA. My understanding of the case is that it allows EPA to regulate greenhouse gases as pollutants. I'm wondering, I guess direct to everybody, what are the chances of that actually happening? And if it doesn't happen, are there any court remedies to compel them to do that?
Sure. The question concerns Massachusetts versus EPA, which held that carbon dioxide is an air pollutant and that EPA can regulate it. The question from the audience is whether somebody thinks that EPA is going to act on that, and if they don't, what recourse does people interested in regulation do people have if they fail to act? You want to start?
What the court held was that the statute required EPA to take some action or to explain why it wasn't going to, based on standards set forth in the statute itself, and that the reasons that the EPA had given for not regulating were not grounded in the statute and therefore couldn't justify its refusal. So it's not so much may they, it's actually they must, unless they come up with some reason for not doing it. And if they come up with some reason, then they're going to have to explain why the statute allows that particular reason as a reason not to go forward.
So scuttlebutt apparently has decided to go forward.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that.
Ben, any comment?
I mean, I guess just as it relates to our case, our position is that until EPA sets particular limits on carbon dioxide emissions from power plants, that our case is entitled to go forward and is not yet preempted.
Other questions?
Just for the benefit of the audience, and I'm not going to argue with Ben about this, just so you understand, we've talked sort of very obliquely about federal common law and whether there's a remedy under federal common law. One of the doctrines under federal common law is, again, because it's sort of a, it's called interstitial, it's a doctrine of sort of necessity, filling gaps. One of the principles that governs is that when Congress acts, it can displace or preempt, as Ben mentioned, federal common law. So that's another question we have in our case. We've fought over whether the statutes that Congress passed before EPA took any actions were enough to foreclose the courts from going forward. And as you can imagine, since the EPA case came down, we've said now this is more than sufficient to displace, and Ben, as you just heard, disagrees.
Yes, sir.
As far as the balancing test as a public nuisance theory, I don't understand how you can get to that without answering a political question because of the specific utility situation. Normally, if you have someone that is going to sue under public nuisance, they get an injunction or they get some kind of relief against that person, it's going to help them because they're right next to that pollutant. In this case, you're actually going to severely, probably economically injure those persons based on your theory of switching fuels because they're the captive audience for that utility, which is going to raise their, probably their utility electricity bill substantially every month. So when you do that weighing, actually, you're going to probably economically severely injure those people. Where before, you know, you could buy out the right to pollute them, and I just don't understand how you balance that with the political question.
Well,
I don't know whether I can repeat this question, but it has to do with how you apply the balancing test in a case where, unlike a nuisance case where it's a polluter next door who can stop, you have a situation here where victory will increase the costs of the people that you've sued and also increase, I guess, the cost of the public. And how do you balance all of that under the nuisance doctrine? Ben?
Well, I mean, I do think a court will take a look at that. And again, at this stage of the case where the allegations of our complaint must be taken as true, we've alleged and we, in fact, think we can show that electricity rates for the consumer will not rise, or if they do rise, it will not be dramatic. And in fact, I do think there's studies from, I'm trying to remember if it's the electric power sector, it may not be, but some other sector of industry that supports that position. So we just want the opportunity to present those facts to the court, and we do think we can show that the harm to any electricity consumer is going to be minimal.
I'm not going to debate that proposition, only to this extent, to just note that the 8 states that sued the 5 utilities, none of them has any of these utilities operating in their jurisdictions, or I think maybe one or two plants may operate in one such state. So there is a quality of, you know, we want other people to bear these expenses, and it'll be good for us in our state, but it's notable that they did not sue the utilities in their own jurisdictions by and large.
If I could just respond briefly for the state.
I think time's up.
No, I mean, like I said, part of what the court is going to look at is what policies these particular states have enacted within their own jurisdiction.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would dispute, for example, that the state of California is in the vanguard in this movement in the carbon dioxide legislation that they've passed, and the same goes for the other plaintiff states. And so I don't think this is a case where a state is calling out power plants located in other states without having done anything itself. Just make that point.
All right, let's take one more. Bruce?
Yes, we've been talking throughout about these doctrines, of course, and you've been thinking about this at a doctrinal level, a political question standing, but I'm wondering what your reactions would be to the idea that what we're really saying is, in these types of cases, it's unconstitutional for the court to go forward, and is that something we should be worried about? And maybe this goes to a point perhaps that John was making earlier, that we're using an awfully strong remedy here to get rid of these cases at an early level, at an early stage. And I guess a related point, if there's even time to address it, is whether plaintiffs are really hoping to find something juicy if they were able to get a discovery, a la tobacco litigation.
Okay. Well, why don't we ask that question of Ben, or anyone to comment on, and that is, if these cases had gone forward to the discovery stage, what would be the expectation that information would be found that would make it more likely that the court would rule in the favor of the plaintiffs?
As I articulated before, historically the electric utility sector has lobbied hard against any emissions regulations, and we believe that there is evidence that we would obtain through discovery that would show that they've been aware of the global warming problem for a while. They knew of the likely impacts. They withheld information from the public that's contained within their files, and that they chose not to address the problem. That's fair to put in front of the court when it's conducting a balancing test in terms of a remedy. I do think there's juicy stuff in the file, so to speak.
Well, we may never know. One last question. Doug?
I just noticed the Supreme Court this week granted cert in the Exxon Valdez case, and one of the questions is whether the Federal Clean Water Act overrides, preempts the federal common law of maritime torts. I just wonder if you think that case and the outcome of that case is going to affect this litigation at all, and whether you're going to weigh in, whether you're going to file a brief or anything.
Well,
The question concerns the fact that the Supreme Court has taken cert in the Exxon Valdez case and whether the outcome of that is likely to have any bearing on these global warming cases.
At the rate the Second Circuit's going, we could have a decision in the Supreme Court case and be submitting Rule 28J letters all over again. I do think the issue is germane to the issue I mentioned just a moment ago, which is this displacement idea, because we had a big battle in the Second Circuit over what it takes to displace, and one of the doctrines that's out there is that maritime law is sort of a unique area where the Constitution essentially has been interpreted to assign the federal courts the primary role of making law for maritime matters. And so it's harder generally to displace maritime law because courts have a more prominent role in creating it than it is other types of federal common law, or so we argued. Ben may disagree. And so, but taking that as a premise, I think if the court were to find displacement in that case, that would be sort of an a fortiori case for us.
John wanted to make one very brief comment in response to Bruce's question a minute ago. Okay.
I just want to make the point that if you're litigating on behalf of a point of view or a cause, it's always good to win. And better to win than to lose. And not only because you want to win or lose a particular case, but because winning has all sorts of good collateral consequences. When the judge is writing an opinion and hands you a victory, he or she tends to write all sorts of other things that are helpful. Conversely, when you lose, there are adverse consequences. And as I've suggested, there are a whole lot of things in these opinions about the scope of the political question doctrine that give me pause, and that if this reasoning is upheld, then it is going to be trotted out to defeat other kinds of claims. And I think that would be an unfortunate consequence of this litigation strategy if that's what comes out of it.
Okay. Thank you, audience, and thank you, panel, for a terrific job. And now we'll hustle away so the next group can come up.